I was telling them about the Puerto Rican restaurant we tried downtown.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty good.
The pinatas.
The pinatas. I'm such an idiot. I was like, I think I realized after I said it, I was like, she's not going to know what I'm talking about because no one eats the pinata. You eat what's in the pinata, usually.
Yeah, candy and toys.
Toys?
Yeah.
You eat toys, Rob?
No. Who eats toys?
Okay, I really like the cover of that book. Can I see?
Yes, but I'll need it back because I have to quote.
You're going
to
quote?
And I
cocaine!
Ooh. Was it good?
Yes. Yes. Ooh. And no. I'll get into it in the episode, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool.
What is the book called?
The Man from the Train.
Oh, very nice.
Like the hillbillies?
Thrift books. Mm, yeah. I like thrift.
I don't pay like more than $6 for a book.
Hannah?
But these are used.
Dude, I'll spend too much.
Is this a store?
Yeah, it's online.
Oh.
But also Book Outlet, you get cheap books and they're new.
And what is shipping?
Shipping is free if you spend a certain amount.
It'd be so easy to spend $40-$50.
They sell gift cards? Send me the site. Thank you.
He's thinking for my birthday.
I know. Book Outlet is free shipping if you spend $35.
Oh, okay. That's easy. That's one book.
No, it's seven books because they're usually like $5.
Oh, there we go.
They're like new books for really cheap, under $10.
And can you sell your own books on there?
On ThriftBooks, you can.
Nice.
I was going to try it because I want to get rid of some.
I have a whole library full of books that are just sitting here.
These are my friends.
Rob, do you have a death wish?
I have a relationship with every single one of these, so shush.
Do you have a death wish?
Not at all.
She knows how to murder people.
Yeah. Rob.
I mean, we've been studying
a divorce wish, at least. Okay.
Do you spend your free time binging all things true crime?
When you turn the lights off, do you run upstairs so a murderer doesn't get you?
Do you get out of bed just to make sure the doors are locked?
Is your pepper spray your trusty friend?
Well, then, we're the podcast for you. We're a couple of sassholes, just two ladies from Kentucky giving you the lowdown on all things murder.
Tune in and give a listen.
We know you won't regret it.
Hi, I'm Jess.
And I'm Hannah.
Join us as we delve into true crime, paranormal encounters, and all things spooky.
So grab your flashlight and get ready to wander into the darkness with us.
This is Wicked Wanderings.
Jessica.
And hello, Rob.
Hello.
And we have our special guest, Kaylin.
Woo-hoo!
What's up?
Junior Wanderer.
Kaylin is our junior wanderer, and we just finished recording her own episode that she's doing.
Which will come out in a couple weeks.
Yes, from when this airs. So we're excited.
Can't wait to hear my own annoying voice.
It does take some getting used to.
Yeah.
But now, let's talk about murder.
Yay.
So, in my last episode, I talked about the Villisca Axe murders in 1912 in Villisca, Iowa, where a family of six and two children staying over were killed with an axe while they were sleeping. There are a couple suspects, a shady private detective, a couple of slander lawsuits, and two trials involving a perverted Presbyterian reverend who liked eliciting young girls to pose nude for him.
Ew. Gross.
Gross. The first trial for this reverend ended in a hung jury, and second trial he was acquitted and the case is still unsolved. But what if I told you that there were a string of axe murders that happened across the United States from 1898 to 1912?
I tell you to get out of town.
Okay.
I'd keep you, Jess.
Aw, thanks.
Hey, you can't be the new favorite. That's not how it works.
So I know when we did the Lizzie Borden episode, we talked briefly about the rumors of a crazed axeman murdering people. However, that wasn't known back then. So I don't think that the murders were really connected until 1910. Plus, the Lizzie Borden case doesn't match this guy's MO at all.
Hmm. Okay.
So this guy, I mean, if we think back to Villisca, he killed them in the middle of the night in their beds. And the entire family was killed. Where Lizzie Borden, it was just the dad and the stepmom. There were still people in the home, and it was during the day.
It was the uncle.
So sorry, not sorry.
I mean, it would be really cool mm-hmm. if it was all connected, but I feel like theirs was way too personal for it to yeah. be.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Consensus. Okay.
I agree. So the main source I used for this episode is The Man from the Train by Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James. You asked how I liked this book before we started recording, and I kind of go back and forth. Like, it has a lot of facts to the cases, but also a lot of, like, conjecture. Mm-hmm. But they researched, like, hundreds of similar crimes that happened during the time and have written the book, giving their opinion about what type of person that they think would commit these crimes and identified the crimes that are eerily similar to Villisca. While this isn't necessarily a part two, I will be mentioning it a lot during this episode. So if you wanderers out there haven't listened to episode 33 yet, please do so you can be as intrigued and horrified as we are.
So how did you decide to connect the two together?
Honestly, I think I was listening to Morbid one time at Bandcamp. And they did an episode on the Villisca axe murders, and they mentioned this book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so me
got your
being,
wheels turning.
Yeah, me being the shopaholic I am, I bought the book at the time.
You and also I've, like your rabbit holes.
Yes, you know how I feel about rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. So I bought this book at the time and figured it would be a good time now that we have a podcast to read it. So yeah, I think listening to the Villisca episode will kind of help understand more of what we talk about today and why these cases are worth further research.
Yeah.
And I think you'll see how they'll be connected once I get talking, obviously. So after all the research is said and done, Bill and Rachel have identified 21 cases that they believe with 70% of certainty that they were committed by the same man. So 21 cases across the United States in 14 years. I am only going to cover a few of these cases, even though there are more that share some of the same characteristics, but I think we'd be here for like 5 hours if I talked about all of them.
Hey, I'm okay with that.
Kaylin would love to stay.
Sleepover.
And also, I was going to talk about more, but it just is the same thing over and over again, and it's kind of horrific. So I am actually going to start with the one that happened after Villisca and work my way back to the case that the authors believe was the man from the train's first murder. So buckle up, wanderers, as I take you on this wild cross-country ride. I know, I'm a nerd. Don't look at me like that. Rob, you do not have a poker face, sir.
What are you talking about?
You gave me the most ridiculous look when I said that. You know what? It's okay.
Maybe we should start doing this podcast as a video podcast.
That would be cool.
Mm. But I like it dark. You said you won't be able to do it.
Yeah, it needs to be scary. Brighter.
Hannah lives in darkness.
I do.
She's a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now, remember the Villisca murders happened June 9th, 1912.
Titanic. Well,
there was another murder 3 months later on Friday, September 27th, 1912. And this involved the Van Schmidt family, who lived in a farmhouse near Payson, Illinois.
Van Schmidt.
Van Schmidt.
That was a Van Tassel.
It's spelled P-F-A-N Schmidt.
Oh!
Schmidt.
Fan Schmidt?
Span Schmidt. Yeah. Fan Schmidt?
Oh, not Van Schmidt.
I said fan. You know what? It's Fan Schmidt. This family lived in a farmhouse near Payson. Charles, his wife Matilda, and their 15-year-old daughter Blanche, and a 19-year-old school teacher who was boarding with the family were murdered. Probably, and I use quotations because they did in the book, with an axe, and the house was set on fire afterwards.
I guess, like, what else would make an axe mark?
I mean, any blunt force trauma, you know. Usually, I mean, in Villisca, he used the blunt end. We'll see in another case, there was a gas pipe used, a brick, a stone.
Well, I'm picturing, like, an axe. I'm picturing, like,
a pickaxe.
Like, the slice.
Yeah, right? All right, well, what do I know? Okay, go ahead.
Out of all the, well, you'll see why they didn't know. Well, because it was set on, the house was set on fire.
Yes, yes, that would definitely not help.
Out of all the cases that we will cover, this was the one that was the farthest away from the railroad, which was about 6 to 8 miles. Throughout Saturday the 28th, there was no movement at the farm. Their mail was never collected, chores were never done, horses were never fed, and the cows weren't milked, and several phone calls went unanswered. It wasn't until the early morning of Sunday, September 29th, when the house burst into flames, that anyone knew anything was wrong. Despite the early hours, a crowd of neighbors gathered around the house making futile attempts to put out the fire. The couple's son, Ray, was charged, tried, and convicted of their murders despite weak evidence.
Oh, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. He was actually gone seeing his fiancée that night, and he actually lived in a different part of town in a tent because he had a dirt moving business, so he had his own land.
That's shitty.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he was convicted, but the farm was in an area where the man from the train was most active, and it was only 300 miles away from Villisca, and only 100 days after. So getting into the Wayback Machine to 5 days before Villisca, June 4th, 1912, in Paola, Kansas. The home was about 150 yards from the railroad line. That morning, Roland Hudson did not report to work, and there wasn't any movement around their house. Some neighborly women went to their home and pushed the front door open a little. They could see into the back bedroom, where they could make out two forms lying in the bed. The authorities arrived and discovered a ghastly sight. Mister, that's how they said it in the book, so I had to include it.
Ghastly, not ghostly.
A ghastly sight. I feel bad laughing because people were murdered.
Oh no,
but I was laughing at you.
Dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. and Mrs. Hudson were lying in bed with the covers pulled up over their heads. Mr. Hudson was lying on his right side, and the left side of his head and face were crushed. He was killed while he slept. Does that sound familiar to anyone?
Does it sound familiar to you?
Awkward.
Sounds like the last episode.
Thanks, Rob.
Caitlin?
What's that? Bueller?
Bueller? Bueller. Bueller. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah.
See, she's more cultured than I am. I didn't see it until three months ago. Yeah. Vicky's face.
She's... It appeared that Mrs. Hudson had woken up when her husband was killed and raised her head. She was struck on the backside of the head and her face. Sitting on a box next to the bed was a lamp without its chimney. And a window was open in the other bedroom. The screen had been removed.
I'm sorry, a lamp without chimney?
Yeah, like the old oil lamps or kerosene lamps.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's what I actually had to Google this and see. I had an idea of what it was. But if you remember in Villisca, there were some
right.
chimneys like under the dresser and under the bed that had taken off.
The house you can visit for the Villisca Axe murders, you said, still has no electricity in it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
And no plumbing.
No.
We love plumbing.
Yes, we love plumbing.
See, you love plumbing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Love plumbing.
Sitting on a box next to the bed was a lamp without its chimney. A window was open in the other bedroom, which had its screen removed. And the previous night's dishes weren't done, and serving dishes for three people were on the table, along with photo albums and a box of letters. So they must have spent their last meal reminiscing with a friend. And there was rumors of, like, people had seen someone come in and ask for the Hudsons.
The friend is the killer.
You would think, but why would the friend sneak into the window and take off the screen if he was already there?
Mm.
Right?
To make it look like someone else did it?
I mean, I guess. What is incredibly interesting about this case, at least to me, is that one of Hudson's co-workers named Mr. Longmire lived three houses up the street. Shortly after midnight of June 5th, Mrs. Longmire was awakened by a crash of breaking glass. She stumbled into the hallway and saw the shadow of a man fleeing from her kitchen. Being this true bad bitch that she is, she raced into the kitchen in time to see the kitchen door open and heard footsteps on the porch running away. She then rushed to her 8-year-old daughter's room, Sadie, and her bed was empty. But luckily, Sadie was hiding in the corner, terrified. Sadie told her mom that she saw a man crouched over her mother's bed, and Mr. Longmire, of course, slept through the intrusion and was groggy when he was awakened. You know, in typical male fashion.
Probably taking a couple of those gummies.
Maybe. When Mrs. Longmire returned to the kitchen, she found out that the broken glass had been the chimney to the oil lamp. Its wick turned low so that it only emitted a faint glow. Also on the floor, she found a woman's kimono-style dressing gown that was later identified belonging to Mrs. Hudson.
Kimono come from the Greek word kimona, which means robe.
Really?
My big fat yeah. Greek wedding.
Yeah. I was looking at Vicky because you were talking about the movie the other day.
Is that a Greek word?
Everything can come from a Greek word.
Because I always thought kimono
mm-hmm.
was like an Asian descent.
Yeah, because it's a dress. But the whole point in that movie was that every word can come back to the Greek. So she's like, okay, what about kimono? And he's like, kimono. Kimona, which means robe. Robe, dress, there you go.
Okay, I understand what you're saying now.
You got it?
I get it.
The following morning, Mrs. Longmire noticed that the man had broken into the house by prying off a window screen.
Ooh.
Mrs. Longmire went to the courthouse and reported the crime and turned in the kimono. Don't say it again. I think, obviously, that the murderer, because of the kimono, hit the Hudsons first and didn't get what he wanted, and so then he tried the Longmire house. What did he want? As you will see throughout these cases, that our douchiest of canoes had the tendency to go towards houses with children, and a majority of those with prepubescent girls. Which Ooh. Also might explain why he hit Feliska 4 days later. Thank God Mrs. Longmire had woken up.
Mm. He is a major douche canoe.
The douchiest. Asylum. Right?
He locked asylum, up. Right?
Yes.
Dissect his brain.
Before Paola, Kansas, there was Ellsworth, Kansas, and it was October 15th, 1911. So we're going backwards, remember. The Ellsworth City Marshal, Morris Merritt, stayed up late at night reading his newspaper. He heard a scratching noise at the back of his house, and it sounded like an animal scratching, wanting to come in. The noise stopped, and Merritt went back to his paper. The next morning, Merritt noticed that his back window screen had been taken off and placed next to the house, and there looked like there had been an effort to try and pry the window open. The man must have seen Merritt awake, and then through the window, and then left. But unfortunately, on the morning of October 16th, the showman's dog was hanging around Lori Snook's yard, and the showman's lived two houses up the street from Merritt, and their house was on a hill overlooking the railroad track. Lori was a friend of the family and lived a couple blocks away, and she went to take the dog back to the showman's and discovered that the family of five had been murdered in their beds. Their heads crushed with a blunt side of an axe, which was left in the house. The blinds were drawn. The back door was left open, but the murderer had removed a window screen and entered the house through a window.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A sincere expression of gratitude to our esteemed patrons, Lynn from Massachusetts, Heather from New Jersey, Chelsea from Utah, Kate from Massachusetts,
Margie from Connecticut,
Courtney from Massachusetts, Amber from Idaho, and Stephanie from Massachusetts, for their generous monthly contributions. Their support fuels the engine of our investigative endeavors here at Wicked Wanderings.
You too can become a valued patron and unlock a realm of exclusive content by supporting our mission for as little as $3 a month. Your contribution sustains our commitment to delivering high-quality content.
Visit wickedwanderingspodcast.com and click on the support tab to join the ranks of our dedicated patrons. Your investment not only keeps our podcast thriving, but also ensures that you are at the forefront of our intriguing discoveries with bonus content only available for those patron subscribers.
Thank you for considering this opportunity to deepen your engagement with Wicked Wanderings. Your support is paramount in enabling us to continue our journey into the realms of
and mystery now back and truth to the shit show.
I can totally see where they thought this was all connected with the last case.
Exactly.
I'm just glad the dog wasn't murdered.
Right. Yes. That's what matters.
Well, there are only two that are mentioned with dogs. And for the most part, I think you steer clear of houses with dogs because obviously they could attack him or they'd make more noise. He had removed the chimney from the lamp, leaving it under a chair in the kitchen, and the lamp still burning where the last murders had taken place. He had washed his hands and the axe in a bucket of water that was in the house. And he, for some reason, covered the telephone with a dress and had posed one of the daughter's body in a disgusting manner postmortem.
Ew, fucking psycho.
But had left the other victims in their bed where they were murdered. The axe had been taken from a neighbor's yard. And what is frustrating during this time is that authorities knew or recognized a pattern with these killings, but it almost seemed like they couldn't fully grasp it, or maybe they didn't want to. Because what would that mean? That would mean there was a crazy, murderous monster on the prowl throughout the entire United States attacking at random. That would mean no one was safe. And despite their knowledge of this, they still prosecuted and at times convicted people of these murders, despite evidence telling them otherwise. Before the Hudsons was the Dawson family of Illinois. The Dawson's family lived on the wrong side of the tracks. They were a white family in a neighborhood that was mostly black. William Dawson had his own criminal record for stealing horses and had done some hard time.
Is that like stealing a car nowadays?
Apparently. Grand Theft Horse. He and his wife moved to Monmouth around 1903, and William was working as a caretaker for a Presbyterian church. He and his wife had 11 children.
Damn.
Yeah. But luckily, most of them had moved out by 1911. Three children were still at home. Two of those were lucky enough not to be home the night of Saturday, September 30th, 1911. On Sunday, Dawson failed to unlock the church and prep it for Sunday services. The minister was worried that Dawson might be ill and sent some deacons over to his house to check on him. They would find William, Charity, and their 13-year-old daughter, Georgia, dead. The murders were done with a gas pipe, not an axe, which makes me think that this perp picks a weapon of opportunity. And reasons that the author of the book thinks that this was committed to the man from the train is that the home was only a quarter of a mile away from the railroad. It occurred in a small town. He murdered the entire family in one event, which was actually quite rare for the time, despite us talking about all these cases. The murders were committed late at night after the family went to sleep. A young girl was among the victims. The body of the young girl had been found staged in a staged position, whereas the adults were killed in their sleep. The blinds were drawn. There's an absence of a rational motive and absence of evidence of struggle.
So, I'm sorry, did he use the train then to get around? Is that why he was...
What these authors were thinking.
Okay.
That he was a... They called them tramps back then, which is kind of funny.
Tramps?
Lady and the Tramp?
Mm-hmm. That they're like wanderers and hobos that just travel.
So, my grandmother grew up in West Springfield.
Yeah.
And where her street was... It was really close to the railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. And her mom would always say, do not go play near the railroad tracks because that's where the bums hang out. They would still do it anyways. And there was actually one time they ran into a drunk bum and scared the living crap out of them that they started running home.
A hobo?
Yeah. Because he used to jump the trains.
Drunk bums are scary. Yeah.
And that was right around this time.
1911?
No, she wasn't born until 1932.
Oh, okay.
Jeez, Rob.
Scratch that.
The next example is a double event in Colorado Springs from September 17th to the 18th of 1911. The first family was the Burnhams. A.J. Burnham had tuberculosis and was living in a sanatorium.
Was it called tuberculosis by then? Because wasn't it called consumption
one
time? No,
Rob, it was called consumption.
Okay, I'm just...
no, you're right.
Was it?
Yeah, consumption.
Okay.
I just chose to use the modern word
for
it.
What year did they change it from consumption to tuberculosis?
I have no idea.
Hey Siri, what year did they change consumption to tuberculosis?
So 1800s it was changed.
Oh, so that's where I used tuberculosis. Duh.
Okay.
Tuberculosis.
Anywho, A.J. Burnham had tuberculosis and was living in a sanatorium at the time. His wife and the children were living in their home. On the morning of September 20th, Nettie, who was May Burnham's sister, had walked over to the house carrying clothes that needed mending. May did not answer the door, and the house was locked up tight. The curtains were drawn. There was a grocery bill on the front door from someone who had stopped by earlier. She placed a call to AJ at the sanatorium to find out what was going on. He said he hadn't been home in a week, and a neighbor had a key to the house, and they attempted to open the door, but it was stuck. They were eventually able to force it open, and when they did, the stench of death overwhelmed them. The house had been the same as it had been Sunday evening. The night's dishes were still on the table, and they found three bodies: May, Nellie, 6 years old, and John, 3 years old. Nellie had either awakened during the event or moved after death, as she was not found in the aspect of sleep. And there was something found in the room that would cause investigators to call the perp a moral pervert, or rather, like I said, the douchiest of canoes. But it was never revealed as to what that evidence was, thank God. The blinds were drawn, the house was locked up, except for the window that the perp escaped out of, and there was a bowl of bloody water on the table where he had washed his hands, just like Velisca. With the news of the murders, the crowd gathered around the home. All of the homes on the street were full of activity, except for one. The crowd had noticed that a home that was a few feet away from the Burnhams was eerily quiet. It belonged to Henry and Blanche Wayne and their baby Lula, age 2. Henry also had tuberculosis and had moved to Colorado Springs only a month before. He had met Burnham at the sanatorium, who told Henry that there were homes for rent in his neighborhood.
Have you ever been tested for TB?
Yes.
Ugh,
you have to everyone. In the military.
Yeah. Well, I know I had to for school.
Yeah, for school. If you have it, you get the bubble grows in your arm or
yeah.
something.
Yeah. You get the circle. Mm-hmm. You probably haven't yet, right, Kaylin? Yeah, you will for college if you go.
Really? It was college? I thought it was much younger when I had it.
No, 18.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was before high school. Well, you went to a private school, so...
Ow. Don't know how to flip my hair,
I'm pretty sure for public school...
I didn't need it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you were in Utah.
No, she was in Colorado.
Colorado.
Whatever, same thing. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm pretty sure. I remember it very young.
I got the T-dab with the tetanus shot, but not the... Not the TB, not until the Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
I mean, it's not a big deal or anything. It's just this like little prick and then you have to watch it, but
those little pricks.
Yeah, it's like a little circle thing.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to get the circle right. thing.
No, but the test is a circle.
Which the Band-Aid leaves a circle, at least for me it did. And yeah, because they gave me a circle Band-Aid. So when I took it off, I was like, but it was just like the imprint of the Band-Aid.
Mm. Anywho,
back on track.
There was no answer at the door, but the screen door had been cut, and so the police forced their way in. There were three more bodies, all murdered with the blunt side of an axe. The bloody axe that killed both families, borrowed from a neighbor, was found resting against the Wayne house. In each home, like the other ones I had mentioned, there was a lamp that had its chimney removed. A.J. Burnham was initially arrested for the crimes, but he had an alibi. He was too sick to commit the murders, and he would die of tuberculosis a few months later.
Aww.
No one else was brought to trial for these murders.
Wow.
The next family that was murdered was the exact year to the exact day of the Velisca murders. So 1 year prior to Velisca, on the same day. The Hill family lived south of Portland, Oregon, and on the morning of June 10th, once again, a neighbor noticed no movement or activity around the Hill house. The observant yet coward of a neighbor sent his wife to check on the family.
Oh my gosh, really? Wow.
Typical male thing to do. Would you go check it out, Rob, or would you send Hannah?
I'd probably go check it out with Hannah.
Oh. But she'd be walking in front. She knocked on the door and there was no answer. She tried to look through the window, but they had been covered with clothes. But there was a small gap where she saw the bloody body of 5-year-old Dorothy Hill laid out on the floor, and she ran away screaming. Mrs. Hill had stirred a bit when her husband was murdered, but they had both still been in bed. Their 8-year-old son was murdered in bed, and Dorothy was the only one not in bed, and she was covered with bloody fingerprints. I think you get the idea what this man is capable of. I want to skip over the rest of the 15 cases the authors had mentioned with almost certainty that they were completed by the same man, but I want to name them so they won't be forgotten. The Castaways, Louis, Elizabeth, and their 3 children, Josie, age 6, Louise, age 3, and Alfred, 5 months, March 21st, 1911, in San Antonio, Texas. The Schultzes, of Houston Heights, Texas, March 11th, 1910, Gus, 23, and Alice, 21, and their children, 3-year-old Bessie and an unnamed 6-month-old. The Hood family of Beckley, West Virginia, October 31st, 1909. George, his son Roy, his daughter Almeida, and Almeida's daughter, 12-year-old Emma. The Meadows family, Buchanan County, Virginia, September 21st, 1909. George, his wife Lydia, their 3 children, Will, Noah, and Lafayette, all under the age of 10. Lydia's mother, Betty Justice, who owned the cabin they were living in. The Lilerly family, September 13, 1906. Barber Junction, Isaac Lilerly, Augusta, John, Alice, and their daughter Alice was still alive but died the next day. And this is the only story that has survivors. I'm not sure if the man was in a hurry or if he just didn't know other people were in the house due to it being a large rundown plantation house, but their 3 older daughters survived and woke up when they could smell the smoke of the house being started on fire.
That's a new MO.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we go back, he actually started doing that in the beginning, and he did it at the murder after the Villisca. And I always wonder why, because it seems to me that would cause more, bring more attention to the homes.
Mm-hmm. But it also destroys evidence.
And the reason why it wasn't done in Villisca was because they were closer to neighbors than some of these other ones. The Hughes of Trenton, South Carolina, December 8th, 1904. Benjamin Hughes and his wife Ava, and their daughters, Emma, 19, and Hattie, 14. Now that we've paid our respects, and trust me, there were a ton more cases with similarities, but like I said, it would have taken forever. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty about who the authors think this man from the train was. And spoiler alert, they have a name. Granted, there is no evidence, but based on the similarities of the crimes, they have identified the very first murder and the suspect who they think committed it. So, tell me what you think. The first murdered family could very well be the Newtons of West Brookfield, Massachusetts.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I had no idea that this was going there,
which is crazy. That's a fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
Remind me what that is?
Brookfield, Massachusetts?
No, yes, Brookfield. But the Newtons?
Yeah,
am I supposed to know them?
No, but it was in Massachusetts.
That's like the first ones.
Yes.
Okay. I see where we're going now.
Yes. It was Sunday, January 9th, 1898. No one had seen Francis Newton since Friday. And by Sunday afternoon, the Newton's 15 cows were lowing loud, apparently.
Lowing?
Lowing. And desperate. They were unfed and strained by 2 days of milk. I've never had kids, so I don't know what it's like to have 2 days worth of milk in the Nellies.
So you put lowing.
Yeah, that's
what
it says.
Did you mean mooing?
No, lowing.
Do you think it was a typo?
No, it was in the book.
Oh.
That way.
Okay.
Some of the neighbors, I'm not an expert on bovine terminology.
What?
Bovine. Cows are bovine.
Cows are a bovine?
Yeah.
What's a bovine?
Cows.
I don't understand. Is that like the Latin term or something?
No, it's Greek.
Oh.
Sorry. Everything gets back to the Greek.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so the cows had some milk in their nellies.
That does sound painful, though.
Yeah. Some of the neighbors came over to help with the livestock, concerned why the Newtons would go out of town and not tell one of them. But by 10 p.m. that night, they went over to the two-story farmhouse to investigate. The front and back doors were locked. The curtains were drawn. There were no answers to their knocks or calls. The men eventually found their way in through an unlocked window with a broken pane leading into the parlor. In the first room, they found the mother and daughter in bed soaked with blood, with covers pulled up all the way to their head. Francis lay in his bed, his head bashed beyond recognition. His body remained in his nightclothes with blankets piled tightly to cover his body and face. He was struck 4 times over the left temple. Downstairs, his wife and daughter's head in a similar state, except their nightgowns had been pulled up and their bodies had been attacked as well as their faces. They were not robbed, nor was there evidence of rape. Death was instantaneous for all victims, and the murderer had exited the house by crawling out the window, leaving the doors locked from the inside. Missing from the scene was the farmhand, Paul Mueller. He was last seen the night of the murder heading towards the nearest train yard.
Ooh.
Newton had hired Mueller as a farmhand as he needed help on the farm, obviously, Jess. He was a good help at a good price. Mueller slept in the room just off of Newton's.
Mueller.
Just off from Newton's old bedroom. So it was like the Lizzie Borden house where you had to go through Newton's bedroom to get to Mueller's bedroom, which is kind of weird.
Do we know how far away, what town was this again?
West Brookfield.
Do we know how far away West Brookfield, Massachusetts is from where Lizzie Borden was?
Oh, it's probably a good
It's by Sturbridge.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was
West Brookfield.
More west.
Yeah. Isn't that where Aubrey lives or her fiance?
Oh, yeah. They got a brewery there. That's right.
Yeah. That's where he grew up, West Brookfield. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean,
but we
an
know
hour.
It was the uncle. Mm-hmm.
Train ride. I'm thinking Lizzie Borden.
No, the MO was different.
Yeah. There's, yeah.
So many differences.
I know, but we figured out it was 12 years earlier than the Velasquez.
Lizzie Borden happened in 1892, and this was in 1898. So he could have very well been in the state, but Lizzie Borden's, that stuff does not match.
Right, but that could have been like his very first murder.
This one is the very first murder, Rob.
I'm just saying.
Stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
Fetch?
Agree to disagree.
It's Mean Girls.
Yeah.
Which one? The new one or the old one?
You know what? The only one that matters.
Why?
The old one.
Do they have to keep remaking shit?
I don't know.
No one can have their own creative thought. Nowadays.
I just don't like how they made the new one. We're like, this isn't your mom's Mean Girls. Like, what was that supposed to mean? This is Mean Girls was Mean Girls.
Exactly.
Anyways, but stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
Does that make you feel old?
No, I am young.
I heard the new one was really bad.
Good. I'm so glad.
Like all remakes usually are. According to reports, Newton was happy with Mueller's work, but said that Mueller could be cranky. But then again, Newton did have the reputation for being a strict man and speaking sharply to his hired men. He had also been hard on Mueller and told him that if he didn't do better work, that he had to leave. Mueller was notably other. He was very short and stout, between 5'4 and 5'5. He had long, greasy hair and a poorly trimmed mustache. He was believed to be 35 in 1898. He spoke with a German accent. And his feet were a size 6, which is the same size of the footprints found around some of the crime scenes. And he was an experienced tramp, or vagabond. Vagabond. At 11:30 that Friday night, neighbors had seen Mueller walking away from the farm in the direction of the Brookfield train depot. Others seeing him called out to him saying hello, but he ignored them. The man at the ticket counter remembers a poorly dressed man buying a ticket for Springfield at 1:05 a.m.
Ooh.
Springfield, Mass?
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes, right in your backyard. So now I have to go to the book because I didn't finish typing. So here I quote, Hannah.
And here I am quoting.
He paid for the ticket with a $0.50 coin from 1836. Arthur Rice, one of the neighbors who discovered the bodies and saw Mueller, we imagine that Mr. Rice was all up in the police's face about this case, said that the coin belonged to Newton, who had a coin collection that Rice had admired. The story of Newton's coin collection survived the newspaper accounts of the crime for years, and it was mentioned as late as 1902. The story of Newton's coin collection survived the newspaper accounts of the crimes for years, and was mentioned as late as 1902 as one of the key facts establishing Mueller's guilt. It seems odd that a ticket agent would not at first remember selling a ticket at 1:05 a.m., to a shabbily dressed troll who paid for the ticket with an antique coin. But the police relied on the ticket agent's revised memory and followed Mueller's trail to Springfield. The brakeman on the Springfield Express night train, Arthur Cooley, remembered a small, stout, laboring man with long, dark hair acting shifty, first on the Springfield platform, presumably buying another ticket, and then again in the smoking cab. The man got off, or at least off the smoking car, in New Haven, Connecticut, but not before the brakeman noted his dress in some detail. He wore the dark clothes, and his coat was a rusty color. He wore a light, checked cap and had no bags. Like the Brookfield ticket taker, New Haven ticket agent had delayed realization about a man of Mueller's description in the wake of the attention of the Globe reporters. He, too, sold Mueller a ticket at 4 a.m. on Saturday, about 5 hours after the murders. The ticket was again for a short distance, only to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Though Mueller disappeared onto the train immediately thereafter, and the agent also noted his golf cap of checked design with a red thread. A baggage handler, Tracy, saw the short-capped man getting off the smoking train at New Haven and did not see him get back on. The apparently fashionable and observant man said, "We see a good many men wearing those caps, but they are all students, and so I was somewhat surprised to see a man of his appearance with a style of cap." Brotherton seemed amused by the golf cap, calling it singular in contrast with his poor clothing. Tracy watched the man leave this area, and he did not return. Mueller's trail vanished near the coast of southern Connecticut. He had received mail from his sister living in Paterson, New Jersey, and it was suspected that he might be headed there to seek shelter with his sister. From New Haven to Paterson is 88 miles. But the Mueller-Newton-Brookfield crime was not invisible or underreported, and it was actually widely reported in its day as the Villisca murders had been. Enough information exists that a short book could be written on the case. And the New York newspapers published long stories about the Brookfield murders and the search for Paul Mueller. Reports of Mueller in one prison or another poured across the country. In the first month after the event, 7 different men, mostly transients, as close as Worcester and as far away as Nebraska. Are you laughing at how I say Worcester?
No, transients?
Yeah.
So do you want me to take the word that you just said, transient, and replace it with tramps?
No, transients are tramps.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's fine.
Okay.
Tramps is fun to say.
But I thought tramp was a hooker.
No, well,
that eventually. Lady is a tramp. I mean, that's what Frank Sinatra said.
Yeah, but he don't.
But isn't a hooker a skinwalker?
Don't say that word. You're not supposed to say it out loud.
What's the other name for a skinwalker?
Flesh pedestrian.
Flesh pedestrian. So when I was editing that episode, I finally looked it up.
You did?
Yes.
There's some creepy story. I have a friend. I don't know if he listens, but his friend is Joe. His name is Joe. And he's a Navajo Indian, and I call him Nava Joe.
Nava Joe.
Hi, Nava Joe. But we were camping one night, and he refused to talk about him. He refused to even say the word. So don't say it. Anywho, back to Mueller. On the morning of January 7th, 1899, Paul Mueller probably did not believe he was going to murder Frank Newton and his family. In the 2 months of working on the Newton farm, Mueller had grown to intensely hate Newton. He was a big, strong man who insulted him, ordered him around, and treated him without much respect. Although Mueller knew that he had worked hard and that he did good work, he hated Newton and he fantasized about hitting him in the head with an axe. Yes, but he had fantasized about killing people for many years, all of his life, really, and he had never done it. He did not truly expect this Friday would be any different. Something must have happened that day, though, that would make it different. Friday is usually payday. Newton was close with a dollar. He was cheap. It was possible that there was a disagreement about money. Perhaps Mueller broke something on the farm or in the house and Newton was going to hold the cost of it out of his pay. Or maybe Newton and Mueller had gone somewhere on an errand and had lunch and he expected Mueller to pay for his share. Mueller had limited command of the English language, and apparently I do too, and almost certainly did not self-advocate effectively, even in his native tongue, and probably he accepted whatever Newton said or did, but seethed about it. I mean, I don't know about you, but there's sometimes at work that I'm like, motherfucker, but I don't say anything.
Every other word.
Yeah.
Sentence. Phrase.
But it may not have been about the money. It may have been that Newton tried to get an extra hour's work out of Mueller. That was late in the day, or there was a misunderstanding about some task. Or it is possible that Mueller, living in the Newton house, may have happened to catch a glimpse of Elsie in a naked or vulnerable position, and this fired his perverted lust. So this is one thing that I don't like about the book, is like they take it in this direction a little too much. So maybe even that didn't happen. And they mention a lot throughout with the younger girls. And I think it is something that should definitely be taken into consideration about what kind of guy, what type of person this guy was. But maybe he had seen Mrs. Newton in a naked or vulnerable. Come on. Come on. We will never know what it was, but the volcano in Paul Mueller's horrible heart could no longer be contained.
Oh, brother.
Mueller did cut firewood every day and probably carried firewood into the house. On this day, maybe he snuck the axe into the house, up to his room. Maybe he hid it under his bed. He was waiting for the family to fall asleep. Paul Mueller, in Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James' opinion, was the man from the train. And Paul Mueller committed these murders in Villisca as well as other crimes. A serial murder must, of course, have a first crime, and it is common for the first, obviously, and it is common for the first crime to reveal information about him in the later crimes he will conceal. A serial murder's first crime is often poorly planned or completely unplanned. Often, in his first crime, he kills a person or persons with whom he has known ties, making it obvious him the obvious suspect. So, to end this episode, I am just going to talk about the similarities between Brookfield murders and Villisca. Brookfield murders, all doors locked and jammed shut. Same with Villisca. Brookfield, all window shades and blinds completely closed. Same with Villisca. Brookfield murder, murder weapon was an axe. Same as Villisca. Brookfield, blunt side of the axe or sharp. It was the blunt end in both. Both families were attacked after they had gone to sleep. All victims hit repeatedly in the head, some in the body. Victims all were hit repeatedly in the head. Brookfield, victims' heads were covered with cloth, same as Villisca. In Brookfield, a 10-year-old and mother were sexually exposed in death. Villisca, the 12-year-old Lena Stillinger was sexually exposed in death. She had her underwear taken off. The axe was left on the floor next to the girl's bed in both murders, and jewelry and valuables were left in plain sight with both murders. Brookfield murders, Paul was known to be left-handed, and with Villisca, investigators believe that their murderer was left-handed. The fact that Lynn Kelly was left-handed was used against him when he was put on trial for the Villisca murders. So, I don't know what you guys think, but I don't think all these are coincidences.
No, it's very compelling.
Yes.
Just think if they had fingerprinting back then.
That and in the technology, I think it would be really cool if we had like some genealogy DNA or DNA left from the murder scenes that could like connect all these cases.
Yeah.
Well, you said the I don't know how to say that.
Villisca
was never solved. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's all in a box somewhere.
Maybe, but things were kind of done differently back then. Actually, like the murder, I was reading in this book and with the other murders, the police would release the houses within like 3 days and people would come in and buy the stuff.
Oh my God.
Within 3 days of the murders.
That's crazy.
So even if there was anything of use.
Evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another thing that was interesting in this book is that we always talk about it being crazy that people come in and like destroy crime scenes. But that was very common back then. And a lot of neighbors would go in and do the investigations themselves. And that was so when we hear about crowds of people going into these homes where these murders had happened, it was just common practice. And looking at it from a 2024 lens, we're like, oh, my God, the evidence. But they didn't know. They didn't know back then.
That's crazy.
It was entertainment.
That's why you wear gloves.
Yes, wear gloves. But I can totally see all these cases being connected.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think there were, of all the cases they researched, there were 101 victims to include people who were wrongfully accused. In the South, there were some. So what's another interesting thing, everything is interesting, so I'll just stop saying that word, is that the man on the train never hit in the cold months. So during the cold months, he would actually go south. And so all of the ones in the north were done during like the summer, fall months. But the ones in the south that happened during the winter time, they were also in a racially charged area. And almost automatically, all the sharecroppers, I think is what they called them, were charged, the black sharecroppers. And there was one case where three men were lynched.
Oh.
And they were hung for the murders.
For something they didn't do.
For something they didn't do. It was kind of sad.
Very sad.
But yeah.
Well, so, wouldn't the bodies like smell in the summer though?
Probably.
Oh God, yeah.
There were a couple where they weren't found for a couple days. And so, ooh.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And thanks, Kaylin, for joining us.
Thanks, Kaylin.
Thank you guys for coming.
Yes, we love guests. And thanks, Wanderers, bye, for supporting Wanderers. Us. Go like and subscribe on all of our socials.
Please and thank you.
Please and thank you.
And a shout out to our new subscriber, Kate. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Kate.
Bye. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today.
Wicked Wanderings is hosted by Hannah Fitzpatrick.
And me, Jess Goonan.
And it's produced by Rob Fitzpatrick.
Music by Sasha End.
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to leave us a rating and review.
And be sure to follow us on all our socials. You can find the links down in the show notes.
And if you're looking for some wicked cozy t-shirts or hoodies, head over to our merch store.
Thank you for being a part of the Wicked Wanderings community. We appreciate each and every one of you.
Stay curious.
Keep exploring.
And always remember to keep on wandering.
Get ready to rock your style with Wicked Wanderings.
Introducing our brand new merch.
Cozy up in our wicked hoodies.
Or flaunt your vibe in our sweet ass t-shirt.
Join the Wicked Wanderings crew. Explore the mysterious.
And head to our merch store now.
The link is in the show notes below.